We're in Daniel chapter 11, verses 3 and 4, and we've seen there that a mighty king is predicted that we said is Alexander the Great. We've already talked about him substantially back in chapter 8. Chapter 11 is like another more detailed transparency on top of chapter 8, just as chapter 7 is on top of chapter 2. So this is further amplification of some things that we've already looked at and additional things that we have not. Remember, Daniel is prophesying this. The angel is giving him this information about 600 years before Christ. And he's prophesying things that are hundreds of years into the future. Still before Christ, but still hundreds of years into the future. So a mighty king will stand up. And we had just gotten to the place where I was ready to pass you out a chart, which I think is going to be very helpful to us. We have this chart in two different forms. This is the 8.5 by 11 plasticized form. Thank you, guys. You can offer everybody both, and I don't know what people will want, but we have it in the 8.5 by 11 form, which is very difficult for me to see and maybe for you to see, or we have it in this other form that may be less convenient to use, but at least you can see it. This form here, this is the one I think I would be looking at if I was where you are, because I'm not sure that you can see this very well. So we have it here, and we have it in two different forms that are coming to you. If you want both of those, feel free to take them, and they are yours to keep. One can go in a notebook, and then the other one that you can actually read. I like the big form because the letters are bigger. And you may need, where you're sitting there, if you've got anybody near you, you may need to fold it down to the part we're looking at. There's a tremendous amount of information on this chart. We're only going to be looking at a tiny minority of it as pertains to specifically what we're going to see in the 11th chapter of Daniel here. But there's a lot of extra information. So try not to be too distracted by the other things. And we'll just look. Right now, first of all, we're going to be looking at this upper right-hand section as you are looking toward me. This is the upper right-hand section. That's what I have on the board up here. And you see Alexander the Great right here. Or maybe I should point on the slide. Alexander the Great right here. Does that help? It's really important that we stay together on this, because this is one of the most difficult prophecies, not because it isn't pretty straightforward, it is, but because of the rather amazingly minute intricacy of it. In some verses, you're changing generations from one verse to the next, and there's going to be about 20 people mentioned, and they're all going to be on the chart, or at least almost all of them will be on the chart, but if we don't stay together, we're not going to know what we're doing. And I hope these are as helpful to you as I think they're going to be. So if you have your chart folded down to that upper right-hand section there, we've already talked a little bit about Alexander before, and I think we mentioned a bit about him last time as well. He died in 323 B.C., and that's indicated right here. That line is 323 B.C., He died at the zenith of his power, but he left no heir. I think I may have mentioned that Roxana, his wife, did have a son after Alexander had already died. But Roxana and her son were murdered by Cassander, who is one of the four people that, after 7 years, we had Antigonus, Ptolemy the First, Cassander, and Lysimachus. They're the four women. Maybe I better read this verse again. I think I read it last time. I'll read 3 and 4. A mighty king shall stand up. He shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. That's Alexander. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. For according to his dominions which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. So when we looked at this back in chapter 8, we saw that there were four powers coming out of Alexander, and I think that's what the four winds represents here. Antigonus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Lysimachus emerged after 7 years of struggle. And Antigonus decided that he wanted to be a second Alexander, so Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Cassander met him in battle, and Antigonus was defeated and killed in 301 B.C. You can see Antigonus, that line there marks his death or his end. And after that, I think I may have mentioned last week that Ptolemy's foremost general was Seleucus, and he's on the chart right here, comes into play right there. Seleucus, even though the Greek Empire never regained the strength that it had under the unified rule of Alexander, Seleucus takes over instead of Antigonus, so you still have four different ones here. Since Ptolemy had not taken an active part in the fighting, the other three decided that Syria and Israel should be assigned to Seleucus. Okay, are we all together through verse 4 now that you've got the charts? Okay, good. I'll read verse 5. And the king of the south, now that's going to be the king of Egypt whose name is Ptolemy. This is Ptolemy the first. He's called both Soter and Lagai, but Ptolemy the first. The king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and that's Seleucus the first, which is called Nicator, he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. I hope that's followable. One of his princes, Seleucus, who was Ptolemy's general, will be strong above him because the dominion of the Seleucids up in Syria did greatly exceed that of the Ptolemies. The Seleucid Empire at this time reached all the way from Phrygia in the west, clear over to the river Indus in the nation of India in the east. So, big Seleucid Empire. Verse 6. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengtheneth her in these times. Ptolemy the first was succeeded by his son, Ptolemy the second, who was called Philadelphus. He's the one that had to do with the great library at Alexandria in 283 B.C. This occurred, so we're already getting right almost to the edge of our chart. Ptolemy the first is succeeded in 283 by Ptolemy Philadelphus, and he'll be on the next part of the chart, which we'll be looking at in just a minute. Seleucus Nicator was murdered in 281 and succeeded by his son, Antiochus the first. So that's this line right here. Seleucus the first, murdered in 281 and succeeded. We'll just go to the next part of the chart. This is down one level and on the left side, just so we're all together here. Down one level and on the left side. Okay, I can hear paper rustling, so that's a good sign. All right. In 275 B.C., Ptolemy II invaded Syria. So he comes up from Egypt and he invades Syria, but he's repulsed by the Seleucid forces. Ptolemy's naval power enabled him to prolong the war. Hostility ceased in 272 or 271 B.C. without a decisive victory for either side. When Antiochus II succeeded his father to the Syrian throne in 261, now that happens right here, 261. Antiochus I is succeeded by Antiochus II. Then war breaks out again, and the results again are indecisive, and there's a peace concluded in 252 B.C. You have that right here, the number 252 B.C. At this time, Berenice, or there's, according to what I found on the internet, there's at least four different ways to pronounce that name, but she's on your chart here. Berenice, she's the daughter of Ptolemy II, But she is married to Antiochus II for political purposes. The marriage is, it's thought that they will, this will bring the two together. And according to the stipulated terms of the prenuptial agreement, the son of this union would inherit the throne of the Seleucid Empire. So this was a very important move. The trouble was, Antiochus, who married Berenice, was already married to Laodice and already had two sons by her. These sons were Seleucus Callinicus and Antiochus. And then 2 years later, Ptolemy II died. So at that point then, Antiochus divorced Berenice and took back Laodice, from whom he had been separated. And then Laodice, fearing that her husband might again return to Berenice, just had him poisoned, just immobilize him. It's kind of like O.J. Simpson, you know. She's easier to control if she's dead. That's the idea, you know. I just loved her too much, so it's easier to control her if she's dead. And that's the same thing here. Laodice, based on a fear that her husband was going to return to this other woman, just had him poisoned, and then he couldn't. And that wasn't all of it. She encouraged her son, Seleucus, to murder both Berenice and her baby, thus obtaining the throne for himself. And that was done, and he became Seleucus II Callinicus, which is right here, Seleucus II Callinicus. So these are brutal times. What I'm telling you here happened on a regular basis and was not all of that unusual with these poisonings and so forth. Okay, are we doing okay up through verse 6? We will. This only goes on for like another 14 verses or so, and then we get into an area that I think is not quite so fast moving. So thank you for hanging with it here. I'll read verses 7 and 8. Out of a branch of her roots, that is, out of a branch of Berenice's roots, even though she's dead now, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious silver, vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So we're looking for a shoot out of the same roots that Berenice has, and that's at this time, Ptolemy II is succeeded by Ptolemy III, Euergetes. You can see right there, this is the king of Egypt, and Seleucus is the king of Syria. Ptolemy III was Berenice's brother, so he is actually a shoot out of Berenice's roots. A shoot from her ancestry now stands in the place of Ptolemy Philadelphus. Provoked by the murder of his sister and her infant son, and learning that it had been brought about by Laodice, Ptolemy III waged a war against the Seleucids, and this was called the Laodicean War, because you could blame it on her, since she was the one that behind the scenes had been pulling the strings. This Laodicean War lasted about 5 years, and Ptolemy III won a series of victories in which northern Syria was completely subjugated, and the murderous Laodice was put to death. Ptolemy III then was called back to Egypt to care for a local problem, and he returned down there with idols of silver and gold. And he became called Euergetes because Euergetes means benefactor. That's what he became when he took all this plunder back down there. And we're told that he shall continue more years than the king of the north, and from the chart we can see that he did. He continues more years to 222 than the king of the north, who only continues to 225. So, continues a little farther on. It's amazing the detail of this prophecy, and you can see why people want to believe that this was written after the fact, because if the Lord is capable of this kind of predictive prophecies through human authors, then there's really something to the Bible. And that's what a lot of people don't want to admit. Verse 9, so the king of the south And actually, that's in the 1769 King James Version. The only other translation that I know of that says King of the South there is Young's Literal Translation. All the other translations will say either the King of the North, or they will just say he, referring back to the King of the North in verse 10, or they will say the latter. So there is a textual issue here that I don't think we want to go into, because that makes this even more complicated than it needs to be. But we're talking here about the King of the North, not the King of the South, as the 1769 King James has it. We're talking, in other words, about Salinicus II, Callinicus, this man right here. The King of the North shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. About 240 B.C., he succeeded in regaining lost territories as far south as Damascus. He then marched against Ptolemy and was defeated, and no further attacks were made on Syria during the reign of Ptolemy III. He died in 222/221 B.C. and was succeeded by Ptolemy IV. Ptolemy IV was known by the name Philopater, right there. And this Philopater, Ptolemy IV, was one of the very worst of the house of Ptolemy. Verse 10, "But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress." His sons, that is, the sons of Ptolemy II, Callinicus, Ptolemy II was succeeded in 225 by Seleucus III, who died in battle by poison. He was in battle, but he was actually poisoned, and that's why he died, and was in turn succeeded by his younger brother, known as Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great, who was only 18 years of age. So we're getting over toward this section again of Antiochus III or Antiochus the Great, takes over there after Seleucus III. So I think we're up to speed now down through verse 9 and 10. Succeeded by his younger brother. One of the sons is going to campaign against the king of the south, Ptolemy IV. Antiochus III attempted an invasion of Israel in the summer of 221 B.C. He didn't get very far. Antiochus III invaded Israel again in 219 B.C. And you can see that date. Whoops, sorry. 219, you can see that date right here on the chart. It's not too clearly showing up, but you can see it clearly on your chart, where it says that Antiochus invades Egypt. He had to go through Israel to get to Egypt, and that's what he did. By the spring of 217 B.C., he had conquered all of Israel and had reached the Egyptian frontier town of Raphia. So that takes us through verse 10. Verse 11, "And the king of the south shall be moved with choler," or bitterness, "and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth," he is the king of the north, "he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand," that is, into the hand of the king of the south. At this Egyptian frontier town of Raphia, Antiochus III met not just a defeat, but a disastrous defeat. Antiochus had 62,000 foot soldiers, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. Ptolemy met him with 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants, and Antiochus was defeated. The Syrians are reported to have lost 17,000 soldiers. Verse 12, "When he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, but he shall be cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it." The Syrians lost 17,000 soldiers, but Ptolemy IV, one of the worst of these kings, Ptolemy IV Philopater, was too dissolute of a character to utilize his success to its fullest. He just resumed his life of luxury and dissipation and died himself in 203 B.C. So we need to go on to the next and This is the final section of this chart that we're going to be looking at. Died in 203 BC, right here on the final section of the chart that we'll be looking at. So he had control of the promised land for a little while, but it was not going to last. Verse 13, "For the king of the north shall return, and he shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches." While Ptolemy the fourth was living it up and letting his defenses deteriorate, Antiochus was making plans of his own to annex the Holy Land. I've told you before that these Ptolemies and Seleucids, one on top of the Holy Land and the other to the south of the Holy Land, they used the Holy Land, and it is called one time in the Bible in the book of Zephaniah, the Holy Land. They used it like a rope in their own tug of war, their own private tug of war. So Antiochus is making plans to annex the Holy Land now. He gathers a vast army and better equipment than before and launched an attack. Ptolemy IV, Philippa, there was dead by this point. His son and heir apparent was only 4 years old. He's called Ptolemy V, right here, Ptolemy V Epiphanes. He's a child king, and on your chart under his name it says child king, right there. He's only 4 years old. And obviously unable to rule for himself, so he had somebody else would look after this for him. Antiochus finally won a decisive victory at the Battle of Panion in 198 B.C. That's right, mentioned right here, 198 B.C., Battle of Panion. The years here in this verse 13 are the time of Antiochus' defeat by Ptolemy IV, or the return of Antiochus and his victory at Panion. Verse 14, we're getting close to where it's going to slow down now. We're getting closer. "In those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand." Antiochus III makes a league with Philip of Macedon and probably had the help of some of the rebel forces or malcontents in Egypt against their own government. Antiochus had the support of some of the Jews. Remember, God is interested in these empires mainly as they relate to his people. So we're going to see the Jews coming into play here more and more. This has been just background. After the Battle of Panion, near the sources of the Jordan River, Scopas, the Egyptian general, fled to Sidon, where Antiochus besieged him both by land and by sea. Scopas was forced to surrender, leaving all of Syria in the hands of Antiochus in 198 B.C. Verse 16, "But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land," now that's the land of Palestine, the promised land, the land of Israel, "by which by his hand shall be consumed." In passing through his newly acquired territories, Antiochus III came to Jerusalem, and it was at Jerusalem where, according to Josephus, the inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem gave him a cordial welcome, the glorious land referring to Israel. That last phrase, which by his hand shall be consumed, I think could be translated a little better. This means, the meaning here is that he had complete control of the land, he had control of its people, but it wasn't consumed in the sense that he devastated them, it's just that he had control. He is going to have the power to control it. That's the way the New International Version translates that particular phrase, and I think it's correct in that. He will have the power to destroy it, but that doesn't mean he's going to destroy it, it's just that he has the power there. And he did some good things. He released Jerusalem from all taxes for 3 years, and afterwards released them from one-third of their previous taxes. He sent a large sum of money for the service of the temple. He released the elders and the priests and the scribes and the singing men from all taxes. And he was involved in the minute details of their society, as you can see, with new legislation and so forth. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. He shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side and neither be for him. Verse 17 is very interesting. Antiochus III plotted to throw all the power of his kingdom at Egypt in order to conquer Egypt. He plotted that he would give his daughter to Egypt to corrupt Egypt. In a treaty in 198 BC, Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, who was by then about 7 years old, Antiochus betrothed his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V when they were very young. Now, this is not the famous Cleopatra. The famous Cleopatra is Cleopatra the VII, and she's way down here in the time of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony on the next part of the chart that doesn't even figure into Daniel 11. So this is not the famous Cleopatra. The famous Cleopatra is Cleopatra the VII. This Cleopatra we're talking about here in verse 17 is Cleopatra the I. This was the first of these royal girls that was known by that name. And she is mentioned on your chart right here, Cleopatra. Here he marries Cleopatra over here, and she's mentioned over here as well after she has children. So anyway, what I was going to tell you was that Antiochus betroths his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V to bring these together. And they're just kids. The marriage wasn't actually consummated until about 5 years later. But Antiochus was hoping, of course, that his daughter, Cleopatra I, would be his ally in Egypt. And that way he gets Egypt as well as having Syria too. But as this verse has predicted, his strategy backfired because Cleopatra constantly helped her husband against her father, fulfilling the words at the end of the sentence that she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. She was for her husband instead of her father. So this is a minute fulfillment of the details of this prophecy. Verse 18, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. When Hannibal, from down in Carthage in North Africa, was defeated by the Romans in 202 BC, Hannibal fled to the east and took refuge at the court of the Syrian king Antiochus III. And Hannibal, of course, after the trouble that he'd had with Rome, he wanted to cause Rome as much trouble as he could. Hannibal encouraged Antiochus to invade Greece, and Antiochus went ahead and did so. It was predictable then that Rome would declare war on Antiochus, and Rome did, and Rome was growing stronger all the time in these years. Rome defeated him and caused him to retreat to Asia Minor. And there at Magnesia, between Sardis and Smyrna, two very famous Bible towns, and Magnesia is not as famous, but it's right between Sardis and Smyrna, which were close together, the Romans defeated Antiochus in 190 B.C. 190 of B.C. is just right in this area here, 190 B.C. And it's listed right down here, the Battle of Magnesia, right down there. And some of these scriptural dates, or scriptural references, are actually mentioned here. There will be one that I don't agree with the makers of this chart on that we'll come to later, I think, but most of them I think we can agree heartily with. After this defeat at Magnesia in 190 B.C., Antiochus had to pay enormous amounts of money for tribute. He had to surrender his war elephants, had to surrender his navy. The Romans were really hard on him. And his younger son, who was later to rule as Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, that we've talked about before back in chapter 8, was taken to Rome as one of the hostages to make sure that the money all got paid. Antiochus III, in 187 B.C., trying to replenish his exhausted treasury, he attempted to plunder a temple near Susa But Daniel had been told by the angel here, he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Both Antiochus the Third, the Great, and his soldier, he and his soldiers were slain in that attempt. So that takes us to verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. The next to rule was Seleucus the Fourth Philopater. Right here, Seleucus the Fourth Philopater. After Antiochus the Great or Antiochus the Third, both of those names applied to him. Seleucus the Fourth Philopater is the son of Antiochus the Third. He is the brother of Antiochus the Fourth, who was away at Rome as a hostage. Rome had so thoroughly defeated Syria at this time that she was charging them an annual tribute that was debilitating. Syria had to raise the money, and in order to do that, they had to exact heavy tribute from the nations that were tributary to Syria, tax them a great deal so that they could pay Rome. And one of the nations that they were dominant over at this time, of course, was Israel. So they raised the taxes down there. And a special tax collector by the name of Heliodorus, you can read about him in 2 Maccabees chapter 7. Heliodorus was sent to Jerusalem to take away the treasure of the temple in Jerusalem. But a divine apparition was supposed to have frustrated him in that. You can believe that or not, I don't know. But that was the story, that a divine apparition frustrated him in that. Heliodorus, as prime minister, by the way, has been supported by archaeological evidence. After a short time on the throne, Seleucus IV was suddenly and mysteriously removed, apparently through poisoning by Heliodorus, just as a political expedient, you understand. It's nothing personal. I'm not mad at him. I'm just poisoning him. He's inconvenient. Got to get him out of the way. And there was a lot of that kind of thing here. Now in verse 21, we come to the very famous personage that we looked at in a portion of chapter 8. In his estate shall rise up a vile person, a contemptible person, a despicable person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. This vile, despicable person is Antiochus IV, also known as Epiphanes. He named himself Epiphanes, which means illustrious. The illustrious one. He gave himself that name. As I told you when we talked about chapter 8, the Jews called him Epimenes, which means the madman, but they didn't call him that to his face. He illegally usurped the Syrian throne. I've told you that this man was a scoundrel of the first water and the lowest order. Demetrius I, who was the son of Seleucus IV, was sent as a boy to Rome by his father to serve as a hostage. He was detained there during the reign of his uncle, Antiochus Epiphanes. Seleucus IV also had another son, Antiochus, who was a baby in Syria, and either one of these sons would have been more eligible by law to be king than Antiochus Epiphanes was. But Antiochus had served as a hostage in Rome for 14 years. He happened to be at Athens when the death of his brother, Seleucus IV, occurred. And the way he came to rule is indicated by the phrase in this verse, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. The kingdom was not given to him in any honorable way. It was not given to him by the right of succession. He just took it, and nobody was able to do anything about it. And he did it by catching people unawares by intrigue and deceit. He began by posing as the guardian of the boy king Antiochus. And when the boy king then happened to be murdered by Andronicus, then Antiochus put Andronicus to death, so you're rid of both the boy king and the guy that murdered him. And by flattery, Antiochus IV won the king of Pergamos over to his cause. The Syrians eventually gave in to him peaceably because he was such a master of intrigue. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes, this vile person in verse 21, as we've said when we looked at chapter 8, he made at least three campaigns against Egypt. And, of course, Israel from Syria was on the way to Egypt. Israel, like the rope in that tug of war, I think that's an apt illustration to keep in mind. The armies of the Syrians and the Ptolemies just surged back and forth through the promised land, decimating it again and again with their armies. Each one was trying to take control of everything. All right, verse 22. We're going to be stuck on Antiochus Epiphanes for a while. And with the arms of a flood, they shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. The prince of the covenant I take here to be the high priest of the Jewish nation. He lost his rule. In the early days of Antiochus Epiphanes, Jerusalem was ruled by a high priest named Onias the Third, and you can see him up here on the chart, Onias the Third. Onias the Third was the son of Simon the Just. Simon the Just was a traditional Jewish priest, with everything that conjures up. He was a descendant of this man, and Simon the Just had held a strictly Orthodox view. But as we've talked about this before, the Hellenization of the whole area that Alexander the Great had taken over had a lot of effect in Israel. And the Jews who looked favorably on Greek culture, and there were a lot of them, they opposed Onias the Third and backed the cause of his brother Jason. Here's his brother Jason over here. By promising a larger tribute to Antiochus, Jason succeeded in having himself appointed high priest. This was an era when the high priesthood seemed to be open to the highest bidder. And we'll see that happen more than once. Onias was killed by the command of Antiochus Epiphanes in 172 B.C. And then Jason, who changed his name from the Hebrew Joshua to the Greek Jason, Jason then further encouraged the Hellenizing of Israel. And we talked about this substantially back in chapter 8. I don't know how many details I gave you there, but in these years, a gymnasium was built in Jerusalem, like a Greek gymnasium. The Jewish boys exercised there in the nude. Greek names were adopted in place of Jewish names. This was true for both people and cities. Greek names instead of Jewish names. So the Hebrew ways and the Hebrew doctrines were viewed as being old-fashioned, behind the times, antiquated, and out of date. We want to be modern. We want to be up to date. We don't want to be old-fashioned. So let's get with the Greek program. But in opposition to the paganizing of their culture, there arose a resistant movement that was so zealous it became fanatical. These were the Hasidim, or the separated ones, as the term means. They swore to follow the ways of their Jewish fathers, even welcoming death in order to do so. So Antiochus was looking for ways to solve all of this unrest in the nation of Israel. Menelaus of the tribe of Benjamin, and we mentioned him briefly back in chapter 8, Menelaus is right up here. He's in between a couple of Jason's times there. They had to put him above and just put an arrow down because his reign wasn't very long. But he did have a marked effect. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. So, of course, he could make no legal claim, not being from the tribe of Levi, to the office of a high priest. But by offering a higher tribute to Antiochus than Jason was paid, Menelaus was named to the office of high priest. A Syrian garrison was stationed in the citadel in Jerusalem in order to ensure order and respect for the new high priest. And Jason then began plotting to regain his office. So you have all this intrigue, the way that God had set this up back in the Pentateuch times for the high priesthood and so forth. Nobody's even caring about that or thinking about it, or nobody in power is caring very much about that. Jason is plotting to regain his office. Verse 23, with the arms of the flood, they shall be overflown from before him and shall be broken. Yea, also the prince of the covenant. So meanwhile, Antiochus is campaigning against Egypt, and by intrigue and deceit and flattery down there with a comparatively small army, he won a significant victory. He captured Memphis and most of Lower Egypt and Central Egypt. By Lower Egypt, we mean the highest part of Egypt on a map because it's lower in altitude. The Nile River flows north into the Mediterranean Sea, and it's kind of hard to remember that sometimes. So he took a great deal of this upper portion of Egypt, which is called Lower Egypt. He established a friendly relationship with a defeated opponent as possible whenever he could. Antiochus showed kindness to the Egyptians and won the hearts of his foe. He pretended to back the cause of Ptolemy Philometor, his one nephew, against the cause of Ptolemy Euergetes II, his other nephew. And the nephews finally saw that their uncle was practicing deceit and becoming strong with a small people. That's not a very good place to stop, but the clock says to stop. So I hope that that's clear. And Lord willing, we'll take it up again there next week. I don't know whether we'll get finished next week or not. We've got, I'll just say, possibly one or two more weeks.